and men carrying shotguns and holding fierce dogs on straining leashes would point eastward, telling the families there were parks open to them farther along. There was no shade on Northern Boulevard, and the children became cranky early. In desperation, ignoring the no-trespassing private property signs that lined the road, fathers would turn onto the narrow strip of grass between the boulevard and the wall paralleling it, and, despite the dust and the fumes from the passing cars, would try to picnic there. But the guards were vigilant, and it was never long until the fathers had to tell the kids to get back into the car. Later, in Oyster Bay Town and Huntington, they would come to parks, tiny but nonetheless parks, but as they approached them, they would see policemen at their entrances, and the policemen would wave them on, explaining that they were reserved for township residents. There were, the policemen shouted, parks open farther along. Of those who turned off the boulevard, trying to find a beach, the lucky ones found a spot on the five rocky strips on the Glen Cove Peninsula. The others, searching mile after mile for a piece of beach not marked private, seldom even got close enough to glimpse the water, for most of the roads down to it had locked gates across them. They would turn south again, heading back to the boulevard. The more persistent, who determined to head east until they discovered some place to swim or picnic, found the road becoming worse and worse. They would see Long Island villagers sitting on the fences and laughing at the families who, because of engine overheating or in a desperate try at a piece of grass, pulled off the road. The line of cars was so solid, the radiator of one almost touching the tailgate of the one before it, that, once out of the line, it was hard for a car to get back in. And it was fun, the villagers said, to watch them try. At the head of Hempstead Harbor, the inlet that separates the Sands Point and Glen Cove peninsulas, Northern Boulevard dipped down, curving and winding, rutted and potholed, unpaved in one stretch, and became the main street of Roslyn Village. It narrowed as its width was cut by sidewalks in front of little stores, and then, on the other side of the town, wound upward again before resuming its eastern course. Roslynites, watching the endless line of cars, said it took 2 hours just to get through town, but this was, of course, an exaggeration. In 1923, state officials clocked it on successive Sundays and found you could make it in an hour and a quarter. The officials also determined the length of time it took on an average Sunday to get from the Queensboro Bridge to Huntington, a distance of 32.4 miles. The time was 4 hours. If the New Yorkers stayed on Northern Boulevard long enough, there were indeed, after the estates and guards of the Gold Coast had been left behind, and even if the promised parks farther along never materialized, plenty of quiet places with grass and trees in which one could picnic. Why, Smithtown, the township beyond Huntington, alone had 92.5 acres of cemeteries, and fallen tombstones made excellent picnic tables. When the cemeteries were filled, there were always farms, for although the Suffolk farmers were as determined as the barons to keep the foreigners off their lands, they couldn't afford guards to help them do it, and they never seemed to have enough dogs and sons with pitchforks to do the job thoroughly, although they certainly tried. New Yorkers could even swim in Smithtown if they found a beach whose owner wasn't around. Everyone knew they could, because every Monday, newspapers would carry stories about the city residents who, swimming in the choppy Sound without the protection of lifeguards, had drowned in Smithtown waters. Most New Yorkers, however, didn't last to Smithtown. They turned around and slunk home, eating their picnic lunches in their cars, washing them down with bitterness and frustration. If they swam on Long Island, they swam in their cars, in their sweat. Northern Boulevard was not, of course, the only route to the North Shore from New York. There was also Jericho Turnpike. There was one difference between Northern Boulevard and Jericho Turnpike. Jericho Turnpike was 2 feet narrower. And the greed of the robber barons had not been satisfied by the riches of the North Shore. Led by Horace O. Havemeyer, the Sultan of Sugar, a group of them had seized the choicest area of the South Shore, a series of promontories below East Islip that jut out into the Great South Bay about midway along its 60-mile length. They lived there in a splendor equal to that of the North Shore, and they displayed an equal determination to keep their privacy unimpaired. When one of their number, Julian P. Davies, died in 1922, they feared that his estate might be bought by some undesirable, or worse, subdivided. A group of them, led by Havemeyer and his brother-in-law, W. Kingsland Macy, decided to turn it into a private club. The obstacles might have deterred less determined men. Davies had owned only 231 acres, and most of them were marshland that was covered by water at high tide, so that there was only enough solid land for a 9-hole golf course. To make the second nine, they were told, dredges would have to work for a year to haul up sand and fill in the marshland with it. They set the dredges to work. To design the course, they brought over an Englishman who was the most famous golf course designer in the world. To help the members with their swings, they hired a famous touring professional. They staffed the kitchen with the best chefs they could find. For those members who wanted to sail, they built a large boat basin. And when all was ready, they thought of a name, the Timber Point Club, and opened the club to exactly 100 persons. You could play golf there on a weekend, and if there were two other golfers on the whole course, you considered the place crowded, recalls Robert Hollins, the son of one of the members. God, that place was empty. And that was exactly how the members wanted it. As they toured the majestic course that sloped down to the bay, men in caps and knickerbockers and long socks, ladies in long pleated skirts and midi blouses, they considered the lack of people as big an asset as the view. In 1923, Suffolk County established a mosquito control commission and asked various members of the club for contributions. God, the mosquitoes in the summer were unbelievable on that golf course, Holland says. You'd look at the fellow you were playing with, and there might be 20 on his face. But most timber pointers gave nothing. If the commission got rid of the mosquitoes, Mrs. Hollins explained, more foreigners might find the South Shore attractive and try to live there. I'd rather have the mosquitoes, she told her friends. To keep the public out was worth any price. When the property adjoining the Timber Point Club, a 1,500-acre estate owned by an eccentric old millionaire who had never been one of them anyway, George C. Taylor, came on the market after his death, the Timber Pointers raised $250,000 to buy it. Then they hired caretakers, stocked it with herds of deer and flocks of wild pheasant, all for less than 10 days of hunting a year, and an additional guarantee that they would never have to look over from their golf course and see on the land adjoining it anyone they didn't know. Thanks to the barons and the baymen, the sandy beaches of the South Shore were as thoroughly closed off to New Yorkers as the rocky beaches of the North. Those New Yorkers who could not afford the exorbitant charges at Long Beach or squeeze into the limited public area of the beach there were shunted along the South Shore from village to village until they reached the flat, unshaded, bleak potato fields of Suffolk County. And the shunting on the South Shore was along Merrick Road, an artery as narrow as Northern Boulevard and even more congested, which crossed the clogged downtown areas of a dozen South Shore villages and was intersected at 50 locations by the tracks of the Long Island Railroad, so that every time a train came through, the line of cars, miles long, would have to stop and wait until the crossing gates went up again. And still, the need was so great that every summer weekend, families from New York City flocked to Long Island, trying Jericho Turnpike instead of Northern Boulevard, or the South Shore instead of the North, or a side road they had noticed the weekend before, and which would, they felt sure, lead to a beach they could use. An endless eastward-bound stream of baseless hope that lasted from dawn to late afternoon. And all forecasts showed that the need would rapidly grow greater still. The city's population, which had increased by 1 million persons during the past 10 years, was expected to increase by another 1 million during the next 10. Given the need, therefore, and the possibility that Long Island could meet it, the thoughts of reformers interested in parks had for years turned first to the island. Here, they all saw, was the land of the greatest opportunity. But they also saw, even the most unrealistic of them, that the amount of power with which they had to contend on Long Island was such that efforts to create parks there seemed, even to themselves, foredoomed. In the past, the governments that created parks had been the governments of the areas in which the parks would be located. The township and village governments on Long Island would never create such parks. Conservationists had begun to talk about state parks, but a state park had to be created by a state, and New York State's legislature was controlled by the Long Island barons. A dozen proposals by the good government organizations for Long Island parks had been introduced in that legislature. Not one had ever made it out of committee. The scope of the problem discouraged reformers as much as the political difficulties involved. Parks large enough to serve any appreciable portion of New York City's millions would have to be measured in the hundreds of acres. And since Long Island was run almost entirely by hostile local governments and landowners, how could those acres possibly be obtained? By purchase? Long Island property was valuable, immensely valuable in the hills and along the beachfront where parks should be located. By condemnation? Condemnation of valuable property on the scale required would be fantastically expensive, in fact, unheard of in America. And since the barons' battalions of lawyers could be expected to fight condemnation with every tactic available, the proceedings would take years. And if, somehow, the parks were created, how would people get to them? Long highways would be required, and their rights of way would necessarily cross hundreds, if not thousands, of different properties, and that meant hundreds, if not thousands, of landowners who would be ready to fight. And that would mean hundreds and thousands of additional condemnation proceedings. The reformers realized that even in the unlikely event that they won on Long Island, that they actually succeeded in unhorsing the powerful barons, they wouldn't know what to do with their victory. The problem was so big, the reformers thought it was insoluble. By 1922, their park discussions concerned mainly the creation of more small playgrounds in the city, and the improvement of playground equipment. Often, when Bob Moses went home at night, he would be coming from such park discussions, because Smith, trying to maintain his liaison with reform groups in preparation for another run for governor, frequently asked him to be his observer at reformers' conferences. Moses tendered such discussions only cursory attention. With his attacks on Governor Miller occupying his time, wordy debates over whether a playground site should be on 14th or 15th Street interested him not at all. But during the summer of 1922, when Bob Moses went home, he went to Long Island. Invited to weekends in Babylon by friends during 1921, he and Mary had fallen in love with the town, with the bay, with the whole South Shore. In 1922, they rented a bungalow of their own for the summer. So when the discussions on parks ended, he would hurry to the Long Island Railroad Station and catch a train on the South Shore Line. The trips from and to the city took over an hour. 45 years later, Moses could still reel off without effort the names of the stops as the conductors had chanted them. Valley Stream, Lynbrook, Oceanside, Rockville Center, Freeport, Merrick, Amityville, Lindenhurst, and Babylon, and the train was hot. Moses would try to bury himself in work, but every so often he would look up and glance out the window. And after a while, he began to notice that, while most of the route was filled with one-family homes, there were, between some of the villages, thick leafy bands of woods, and, gleaming brightly through the trees, the blue water of ponds and streams. The woods were all to the north of the railroad, the left-hand side of the train going out to Babylon and the right-hand going into the city. Bob Moses began now always to sit on the side nearest them. It was the 1920s, The men around him would be sitting studying the stock market quotations in their newspapers. Bob Moses sat and stared out the train window. One weekend, he went to Babylon Town Hall and asked what the woods were. An old-timer told him he must be talking about the old Brooklyn water supply properties, the streams and the areas around them in Nassau and Suffolk counties that Brooklyn, then an independent city, had purchased in 1874, fenced off and kept guarded, so that, in case of a water shortage, it would be able to dam the streams and use their water. On Monday morning, Moses stopped by the New York Municipal Building and asked a clerk in the Department of Water Supply if the city used those properties. "Why, no," the clerk said. "It never had. There had never been any need. And come to think of it, now that New York had acquired the huge Croton and Ashokan reservoirs upstate and built aqueducts from them to the city, there probably never would be." And suddenly, the eyes that had looked at the mud flats below Riverside Drive and seen a great highway and a great park were looking at something else. The eyes that burned with ideas were burning again, and they were focused on Long Island. Most of the water supply properties were set far enough north of Merrick Road, behind blocks of private homes, to be invisible from it. But Merrick Road was the only way of getting close to them. Moses had never learned to drive, but he obtained from Smith the use of a car and chauffeur and a letter authorizing the guards at the properties to let him enter their gates. And on weekend mornings, as the line of cars from the city crept east along the road, Moses, leaving Babylon, had himself driven west. Arriving at the spot he had marked from the train, Moses would order the chauffeur to drive north along side streets until there was no more road for a car, and then he would get out and walk through backyards and vacant lots and along footpaths until he reached the gates and could show his letter to the guards. Then he would plunge into the woods. They contained surprises. Through the train windows, he had glimpsed in the woods that lay between Merrick and Freeport a small pond. When he got into those woods on foot, he found the pond, but beyond it, he could see another gleam of water. Reaching that, he found a larger pond, and beyond it, another gleam. Beyond that, there was another. There were four ponds, linked by a stream that ran due north, and each of them was larger than the one before. Lilies floated in them. Pickerel and trout flickered beneath the pads. Huge oaks, beeches, birches, and pines surrounded him, and as he tramped steadily north, there seemed no end to them. He was not in a small woods, he realized, but in a forest. It would survey out at more than 700 acres that lay untouched in the heart of Nassau County. There were another four ponds and another wooded 700 acres stretching south from Wantagh all the way to the Great South Bay. There were 595 more acres near Massapequa. Between Valley Stream and Lynbrook, there were only 50 acres, but in the center of them was a lake a quarter mile across. And when he entered the woods between Lynbrook and Rockville Center, he realized he had come to something that dwarfed the others. The thin band of woods that he had seen from the train at that spot ran north for more than 3 miles, broadening as it went. Within the woods were long, rolling meadows. He had heard that somewhere in the woods was a reservoir, where a stream had actually been dammed by Brooklyn municipal engineers decades before that couldn't be seen from the train, and he pushed on, trying to find it. With branches slapping at his face and vines tangling his feet, he came at last to a man-made embankment. Scrambling up, he peered over its top. And there before him lay a body of water almost a mile long and half a mile wide. It was much bigger than the big reservoir in Central Park, he realized. And there was more land around it, he guessed, and he turned out to be right, than there was in Central Park. Back on Merrick Road, Moses saw the cars from the city still creeping along in the dust and heat, thousands of them, tens of thousands, crammed with people searching desperately for a little patch of green, a spot of clear water. and most of them destined that weekend to find neither. And behind him, not a quarter mile from the road, but unknown to all but one in a thousand of the drivers on it, and closed to even that one, was land, a vastness of land overflowing with the fruits they sought. Land that didn't have to be purchased, land that didn't have to be condemned, land that was owned not by the governments of Long Island, which viewed the masses of New York City as foreigners, but by the government of New York City. Land that could be opened to the city's people merely by turning a key. Adding together the acreage of the various tracts of woods, Moses could hardly believe the figures. They totaled 3,500 acres. 3,500 acres just sitting there, empty and unused. And ideally situated. All five tracts were within 30 miles of Manhattan, within 11 miles of the city line. The woods between Valley Stream and Lynbrook, in fact, were only 2 miles from that line. And what you could do with those acres. There could be hiking trails through the woods, of course, and picnic sites in the clearings. But there could be more. When reformers, when park planners in general, talked about large parks, they talked in terms of keeping them unspoiled and rustic, as close to nature as possible. Even Central Park contained relatively few facilities for any sports other than walking. But Moses saw a different vision. He had noticed meadows back in those woods that seemed just made to order for baseball diamonds, and level spaces with only a few trees that could be cleared for tennis courts. Why, a portion of the biggest tract, the one between Lynbrook and Rockville Center, seemed almost made to order for a golf course. And why should people be restricted to looking at the ponds and lakes? Why couldn't they swim in them? That great reservoir alone could cool thousands of sweating youngsters from the city. And there were so many acres available that even after all the facilities were laid out, there would still be vast stretches of woods that could be left untouched, except for rustic hiking trails. Suddenly, the burning eyes were looking at everything on Long Island in terms of parks. Having fallen in love with the South Shore, Moses had done so with his customary fullness of passion. He kept the Babylon Village librarian scurrying to the cabinet in which were locked the ancient, privately printed books that recounted the legends of the Great South Bay. Buying an old Bayman's old, broad-bottomed, very slow motorboat, partly covered with a canopy, which Mary named the Bob, he putt-putted around the bay following the maps described in the books, sometimes with Mary and his daughters, often alone. Heading out to the pier where the Bob was moored, he paused frequently to chat with the sailors who were too old to follow the bay anymore, and instead spent their days sitting on upturned oyster barrels looking out over it. And finding him a willing listener to their stories, the old men told him about hidden inlets and about meadows where flocks of wild birds nested, and he spent long days exploring them. Sometimes, in fact, he spent days that were too long. Then, as he sat in reverie, the bay's ebbing tide would leave the Bob stranded on a sandbar. After a while, Mary knew what it meant when darkness came and her husband still hadn't returned from the bay. She would call a friend, Harry Fishel, whose boat had a shallower draft, and Fishel would go out and bring him in. In the morning, the two men would return to the Bob, now refloated by the flooding tide, and Moses would go back on board with a sandwich Mary had prepared, and spend another day on the bay. Moses' attention had early been caught by the barrier beach, the strip of dunes and beach grass and wild marshes about 5 miles offshore, that from the pier was a long, low line on the horizon across the bay. Baymen called it the Strand. Deserted, except for a few tiny, scattered summer colonies, an aura almost of mystery hung over it. The baymen told stories of murders and duels to the death on it between sailors armed only with handspikes. The summer colonies had names, Short Beach, Gilgo, but the names didn't match those on the old maps he found in the library. The very shape of the Strand was different. That, the baymen explained to him, was because the ocean was constantly remolding it. Because the set of the Atlantic off Long Island was inexorably to the west, they said, Sand and pebbles were continually washed up at its western end, and the beach grew longer every year. But storms, particularly the howling sou'easters, also swept away part of the strand each winter, slashed new inlets through its dunes, closed old ones. The name Fire Island, by which the easternmost section of the strand was known, was actually a corruption of Five Islands, a name given to it in the 18th century when it had been divided into five parts by four inlets, all of which have since completely disappeared. Contrary to the belief, held even by some Long Island historians, that Fire Island was named for the signal fires set by whalers and pirates, the old documents in the Babylon Library, they can still be found there, show conclusively that it was originally Five Islands. Fire Island stretches from Bayshore in Babylon Township east to Mauritius. The western section of the strand, separated from Fire Island by a narrow inlet, parallels Long Island from Bayshore all the way to Freeport. This section was called, vaguely, Jones Beach. Even the oldest baymen weren't certain where the name had come from, but Moses was. In the old books in the Babylon Library, he had read about Major Thomas Jones, a 17th-century Welshman whose valor at the Battle of the Boyne moved King James II to grant him a commission as a privateer. That was far from being a pirate, one of the old books emphasized. It was a legitimate business. Jones made a fortune legitimately plundering ships that did not fly the English flag. In 1695, he purchased thousands of acres of the deserted strand from Long Island's fierce Indian tribes for a barrel of good cider, peopled it with crews which dashed out in longboats to capture whales drifting nearby, and made another fortune. Marrying beautiful Freelove Townsend, he erected a house with thick walls and slits for rifles on one of the necks of land which at that time linked the strand to Long Island. After Jones's death, sou'easters tore away the necks, and the strand became an island itself. Between it and the mainland, the underwater reeds grew thicker. The tides tugged at the sand underneath the Great South Bay, and the channels between the shoals became more and more crooked and treacherous, sometimes shifting course from week to week. People who tried to sail or motorboat to Jones Beach had to get out and push their boats off sandbars so frequently that one bay captain referred to his weekend journeys as his walks to the beach. The summer cottage colonies grew smaller and smaller. In winter, except for occasional hunters after wild birds and a few hermits who lived in caves hollowed out of the dunes, Jones Beach was deserted. Sometimes, when Bob Moses stepped out of his boat onto Jones Beach, he could not see another human being. In front of him would be nothing but a wide, straight strip of the whitest sand he had ever seen, stretching unbroken until it disappeared at the horizon, sliding on one side beneath the ocean surf, rising on the other into dunes covered with tufts of beach grass, little gnarled bushes and stunted trees, with, between the dunes, marshes of a peculiar, striking grayish-green color from which swooped up herons and gulls. He had returned to it 100 times, pushing and pulling his little boat through the reeds to sit lonely on the beach with wind rustling his hair, drinking in the wild, desolate scene. Had he still been the poet he had been at Yale, Moses might have looked at this scene and thought of Byron. But now he was thinking of Parks. He looked at Jones Beach with eyes that had looked at crowded New York City and had seen 100 ways of improving it, and he realized that the emptiness of the strand, its endless, untouched vistas, was a clean canvas on which he could draw whatever he chose. And, looking at it that way, he realized that all the landscape needed was the painting in of people to make it a bathing beach, a great bathing beach, a bathing beach such as America had never seen. Moreover, the people, the masses of New York City, were amazingly close. Jones Beach had seemed so cut off from the world, but, he realized with a start, when he stood on its western end, he was less than 25 miles from Times Square. The problem, of course, was to get the people out there, And now, in the evenings, in his Babylon bungalow, Bob Moses began to study maps of Long Island. One night, he suddenly noticed that the water supply properties off Merrick Road lay in a row. A straight line could be drawn through them. Therefore, so could a road. If a road were built out from New York so that it traversed those properties, a substantial part of the right-of-way would not have to be purchased or condemned. Moreover, the road could give the city masses easy access to the water supply properties, which he had already determined were themselves ideal for parks. And since one of the properties, the one at Wantagh, ran all the way down to the Great South Bay, another road, connecting with the road leading out from New York, could be built south down to the bay without the necessity of any purchase or condemnation at all. Once it reached the bay, it would be directly opposite Jones Beach, and since the bay was so shallow, it ought to be easy to construct a causeway from the end of the road to the beach. That was the idea behind Jones Beach and the Southern State Parkway, Moses would recall years later. I thought of it all in a moment. As he thought about the road, he thought about the Bronx River Parkway. Although it hadn't yet been opened, the newspapers were full of stories about it. With the exception of a 3-mile stretch of the Fenway in Boston, and of course the transverse roads in Central Park, the parkway would be the first highway in the country to eliminate traffic lights and intersecting traffic by lifting all crossroads above it. The bridges that carried the crossroads would be faced with stone to blend in with the scenery, and the bordering right-of-way would be completely landscaped. Newspapers were predicting that it would be the most beautiful road in America. A road through the Long Island water supply properties, Moses realized, would, on that portion of it which traversed the properties, be lined with the beautiful trees he had seen. The north-south road running from it to the bay would be lined with trees its entire length, and the causeway across the water would cross the bay panorama. The roads he was thinking of, he realized, could be more beautiful than the Bronx River Parkway. The line he had drawn on the map through the water supply properties seemed to point like an arrow into Long Island's south shore. Looking beyond its point, the easternmost of the properties, Moses saw a series of promontories jutting out into the Great South Bay. He recalled that the promontories were supposed to be beautiful, and on weekends now, Moses had himself driven east. From the car, he could see that most of the promontories were private estates, but in East Islip, he noticed a large piece of property fenced off but overgrown with underbrush and weeds and apparently deserted. A real estate agent told him that it had belonged to an eccentric old millionaire named Taylor, and when he died, had been purchased by a group of wealthy men who allowed it to grow wild because they used it as a game preserve. There may have been caretakers on the Taylor estate, but Moses didn't see them when he returned to it. Tramping through the brush and the woods, frightening groups of deer, startling coveys of pheasants, he came to a group of outbuildings, all deserted, and all except one, which had been turned into a hunting lodge, crumbling. Looming over them was an old mansion, paint peeling, with broken windows. In front of the mansion was a long meadow of uncut, waving grass that had evidently once been an imposing lawn. Beyond it was white sand, and then the dark blue-gray of the bay, and beyond the bay, just a line on the horizon, the dunes of Fire Island. Stirring the trees, the grass, and the water was the gentle breeze which Moses had learned from the baymen invariably cooled the bay shore every day from about 11 o'clock in the morning until near sundown. Overhead was a lot of sky. To the east, across a little stream, was an expanse of carefully manicured grass, and, on it, the only human figures anywhere to be seen, several foursomes in caps and knickerbockers and long socks striding along with the caddies of the Timber Point Club. Moses had taken to carrying a yellow legal notepad on his excursions. On it now, he began to sketch the property, and on the sketch he drew lines, some to indicate where the bathhouses for the bathing beaches would be, others to show a golf course, still others to outline where a public bridle path would wind through the trees and where the fences would be placed to pen the deer and pheasants so youngsters could watch them. The mind leaped on. Were there similar vacant properties on the North Shore? Soon, through woods and meadows overlooking Long Island Sound, there was striding a tall, athletic figure dressed in corduroy pants, heavy shoes, and, usually, an old and stained windbreaker, and carrying in one hand a yellow legal notepad. Within weeks, Moses had discovered in Smithtown a vacant estate magnificently suited to his purpose. As he walked north through its thousand wooded acres, he noticed they sloped steadily downhill, and he assumed they were sloping down to the beach. But when the woods ended, he found himself staring at a huge, pale green expanse of grass that was actually below the level of the beach beyond. And he thought in that instant of a name for the estate, Sunken Meadow. The road to Sunken Meadow? It could, perhaps, run from New York along the middle of the island, where the only opposition would be that of farmers, but Moses knew at once that the road wasn't going to go there. If scenery was an attribute of parkways, why, here was a chance to run a parkway through real scenery, the Gold Coast Estates. At night now, Moses began to pore over maps of the North Shore, his pencil sketching out alternate routes. He saw on the map the names across which his pencil was sketching: Phipps, Whitney, Garvin, Morgan, McKay, Vanderbilt, Otto Kahn. But he saw in his mind a road bordered, beyond the grassy right-of-way, by the magnificent stands of trees the robber barons had imported from Europe, and by hedges neatly trimmed by their legions of gardeners. And the pencil kept sketching. The mind leaped on. It took as its compass not an island, but a state. The state's other large cities, Albany, Buffalo, Rochester, Schenectady, Syracuse, Troy, Utica, were growing, not as fast as New York, but fast enough. So was their need for state parks. But the state legislature, considering parks a luxury outside city limits, refused to give them any. In 1922, there wasn't a single state park in New York anywhere east of the Hudson River. West of the Hudson, between the Palisades and Buffalo, there were 20, 19 enclaves around famous old mansions or Revolutionary War battlefields that had been purchased by private philanthropists and donated to the state, and one, a 1,000-acre tract on the Genesee River that was New York's only state park of substantial size, donated by Buffalo philanthropist William Pryor Letchworth. Even when the state was given land, it didn't take care of it. In 1923, the total legislative appropriation for upkeep of state parks would be $30,000. The philanthropists or their descendants or the historical societies designated in their wills to administer the parks had to pay for their upkeep. Permanent improvements, even comfort stations, were all but unheard of. Most parks could not be reached by automobile. In 1922, those state parks that did exist in New York went all but unused. Part of the difficulty, Moses had learned while running the Reconstruction Commission, went back to the old question of organization. Fearing, knowing that the state would let them down, the park's donors had turned their administration over to men or societies dedicated to the preservation of historic or scenic attractions. Montcalm and Spy Island state parks, for example, were administered by the Fort Oswego chapter of the Daughters of the American Revolution. Having no authority over private individuals or organizations, the legislature was reluctant to give them money. And since no central body of any type unified their activities, they presented to the legislature the spectacle of separate agencies competing with each other for funds. This lack of unified administration also meant that a considerable potential source of power for parks was dissipated. In many cases, the trustees of the parks were political leaders in the upstate counties in which they lived, and from which came many of the Republican legislative leaders. United, the park trustees could have exerted considerable influence in Albany, but acting separately, they dissipated their influence. State park administration was one area in which the Reconstruction Commission's recommendations had been ignored. A group of the commission's trustees, including many of the upstate park philanthropists, had begun making a comprehensive study of the state's park needs, but had stopped when the commission was disbanded. Moses, not interested in parks, had given the report scant attention anyway. But now he asked the philanthropists to complete the study under the aegis of the New York State Association. He toured their parks with them, urged them to make recommendations for their development, delicately urged the more conservative of them to think in terms of improved roads and enlarged accommodations. And he urged them to start thinking in terms of a unified state park system that would be a formal part of state government. They need not worry about losing control of their beloved parks to faceless bureaucrats in Albany, he assured them. Control of each park could be left in the hands of the men then administering it. And to ensure that future appointments to the commissions would not become involved in politics, the commissionerships could be unpaid jobs. But if there was a single state body controlling parks, the demands for funds from the different sources interested in parks could be funneled into it and focused, so as to put more heat on the legislature. When their recommendations for their individual parks came in, he combined them in a report, a state park plan for New York, which he wrote himself and issued in the name of the New York State Association. The report was a seminal document in the history of parks in America. Its scope was in itself revolutionary. New York's park needs, it said, were so great that they could not be met by ordinary legislative appropriations. A bond issue would be required, and the amount of the issue should be $15 million. But it was not the scope that startled most. New York and other states had floated bond issues for parks before, even if none of the issues had been nearly so large as that Moses proposed. Rather, it was the philosophy. The expenditure of proceeds from previous bond issues had been restricted to land acquisition, and in the word acquisition was embodied the philosophy that had always in the past governed parks in America, the belief that parks were only land, and the trees and grass and brooks on the land, that their sole purpose was to serve as breathing spaces for the city masses and to enable them to relax and meditate among beautiful surroundings, to commune with nature, and that they should therefore be kept in their natural state. If the city masses no longer were content with communing, if they wanted space not only to meditate but to swing baseball bats, tennis rackets, golf clubs, and the implements of the other sports that their new leisure time had enabled them to learn, this was a desire that had not yet been translated into governmental action in the United States. But Moses translated it. The $15 million bond issue, he said, must specifically authorize the legislature to provide for permanent improvements, as well as the acquisition of land, for large facilities which make a park accessible and attractive to people. Conservation, the previous park ideal, had to be combined with recreation, he said. Furthermore, he said, permanent improvements did not mean only improvements within parks. It also meant means to get to them. Parkway and boulevard connections between state parks and between state parks and neighboring centers of population. And state parks should no longer be talked of as separate entities. There should be a state park system. The state should be divided into 11 regions, and all the state parks in each of these regions should be administered by a single regional state park commission. The Long Island parks he proposed, for example, by a Long Island State Park Commission. The presidents of those commissions should sit as a state council of parks, which would coordinate and unify park policy. Moses' park report was soon being read and hailed by park planners all over the United States. But if its recommendations were to become reality, they would have to become reality through a man who didn't read reports and who seemed highly unlikely to be a parks enthusiast. Al Smith somewhat lacked, as one writer put it, Theodore Roosevelt's zest for the strenuous life. If there was a sport in which the governor was interested, his friends didn't know it. He refused to go with them to football or baseball games, or even to boxing matches. When he took his family swimming, he watched them from the beach, his little pot belly protruding through his bathing suit, a cigar clenched firmly in his teeth, eyeing the ocean warily. Smith's childhood, moreover, had not prepared him to appreciate Moses' insistence on active sports for the masses. When Moses began explaining his park's plan, the governor was dubious. Its cost astounded him. "You want to give the people a fur coat when what they need is red flannel underwear," he said once. But Moses had one advantage. Smith's mind was the type that responded most enthusiastically to what Frances Perkins called the graphic presentation. The governor, she said, wanted you to tell him what it looked like. He got more information out of people who would tell him the exact thing they'd seen, who described the detail. Then he saw what it was like. Anxious to improve the lives of the urban poor, he was especially anxious to improve them through things he could actually see improving them. His governorship was distinguished by his emphasis on works of physical construction, solid and visible. Nothing was more visible than the physical entity that was a park, and no one was a more vivid describer, a more graphic presenter, than Bob Moses. After Smith's election in November 1922, Moses persuaded him to visit the New York City watershed properties. They were barren in winter, but with his gift for words, Moses made the governor see them as they could be in summer, with leaves on the trees and people sitting at picnic tables under them. Day after day, pacing restlessly back and forth before the governor's desk, he poured out his ideas in a continual flow of words. Sometimes the other members of Smith's inner circle had to smile at Moses' vehemence and earnestness. Once, as the torrent of words flowed over him, the governor gradually began sinking lower and lower in his chair and, with Moses still talking, disappeared at last under his desk. But when he poked his head up, he was smiling. Moses persuaded Smith to attend a meeting of the New York State Association Park Committee at the Whitehall Club and made a lengthy, passionate speech. At its end, Smith arose. "Bob, you win," he said. He directed Moses to draft a special message to the legislature, asking for passage of legislation establishing a state council of parks and authorizing submission of the $15 million proposal to the people in referendum. On April 18, 1923, 2 weeks after Moses finished the message, Smith delivered it. Under state law, only one bond issue could be submitted to the voters each year. Smith had also proposed an issue for new hospitals and mental institutions. Moses pleaded that parks should come first, but Smith disagreed. When the governor delivered the message Moses had drafted, he announced he would not push for adoption of its proposals until 1924. It was clear to his advisers that the governor was worried about public reaction to an expenditure for parks of such unprecedented dimensions. The reaction was not long in coming. Smith's secretaries reported a most remarkable upsurge in the volume of his mail. It came from the City Club of New York. "Congratulations!" Club Secretary Raymond Ingersoll wrote delightedly, and from Pomona Grange, No. 416, "God bless you. Sincerely, Matilda Hunt, Secretary Treasurer." It came from slum dwellers and suburbanites, and, unlike the mail on most issues, this mail did not contain letters on both sides of the issue. There was, the governor's secretaries reported, apparently only one side to this issue. Everyone was for parks. There was hardly a newspaper in the state, moreover, that did not write an editorial supporting the message. And the praise did not stop at the state's borders. From all over the country, letters were sent to Governor Smith, Albany, expressing hopes that the writer's own states might follow his example. Wrote the chairman of the National Conference on State Parks, "The New York program will stimulate valuable work in other states. You are rendering a real service not only to your own state, but to other states of the Union, which will have the advantage of following your experience." Mark Antony, shrewd politician, knew the potency of parks as an issue. Rousing the mob to fury against Caesar's honorable slayers, he reserved for a climax the reading of Caesar's will. "Let but the commons hear this testament," he cried, "and they would go and kiss dead Caesar's wounds." And it was not the revelation that Caesar had left each Roman citizen, every several man, 75 drachmas that sealed Antony's victory over the citizens' emotions, but rather his revelation that "he hath left you all his walks, his private arbors and new-planted orchards on this side Tiber. He hath left them you, and to your heirs forever, common pleasures, to walk abroad and recreate yourselves." Al Smith, shrewd politician, had risen to the governorship on great issues, and he was not slow to recognize a new one when it came along. An Albany reporter watched the awareness grow on the governor and his circle. You could see them beginning to realize that doing what Moses wanted would be politically advantageous, he recalls. "One of them told me that supporting Parks meant that the governor would be helping the lower and middle class people and thereby winning their support, and that the intellectuals would be for him because they saw Parks as part of the new pattern of social progress. So you'd have all three groups supporting you. And besides, Parks was a word like motherhood. It was just something nobody could be against." During the spring of 1923, Smith assured Moses he would push for adoption of the Park program in 1924. And in the summer of 1923, Moses went back to tramping around Long Island. "I went with him once," a friend says. "We walked all day through one piece of beautiful wild country after another, and he never slowed down. He was tireless." Generally, Moses preferred to be by himself. He walked alone through vast, empty, shuttered mansions, through potato fields where farmers worked peacefully, not knowing that the man looking at them was planning to take their fields away. Walls and guards kept him from getting a good look from paved public roads at the route he was considering for the Northern Parkway, but he discovered unpaved back roads through many of the estates, and he spent days walking along those deserted paths, a solitary figure with a long stride. Through the trees he could see the great castles. At their gates, on little black and gold signs, he could see the names of the great barons who had built them. And the barons, private behind their walls, did not know that staring at those walls was a man determined to tear them down. Few men had ever viewed Long Island entire. One who had was Walt Whitman, who saw it as a sea beauty, stretched and basking, isle of sweet brooks of drinking water, healthy air and soil, isle of the salty shore and breeze and brine. Now Moses saw it entire, and if he had written poetry once, he wrote park reports now. And brooks, healthy air, salty shore, and breeze and brine meant parks. Standing on Montauk Point, where Long Island's southern fluke ends in the steep bluffs plunging abruptly into the Atlantic, Whitman had said, "I stand as on some mighty eagle's beak." Now Moses went to see Montauk, not with the eyes of the poet, but with those of the park planner. "The Montauk Peninsula," he wrote, "is an extraordinary mass of clay, gravel, and rock, with high bluffs on the south shore, and, back of the bluffs, kettle holes and rolling hills clothed with bayberry, shrubs, and gnarled and twisted trees. The irregular shoreline and a number of small islands form a veritable patchwork of smaller peninsulas, straits, and bays, which afford many miles of beaches, dunes, and varied waters for cruising, fishing, swimming, golfing, and other forms of recreation." Driving back from Montauk along the southern fluke, Moses discovered endless other miles of unused beaches in Hampton Bays. He found still more on Long Island's northern fluke at Orient Point, where farmers lived in farmhouses built in the 17th century. Searching out deserted estates, he found two in the center of the island, one owned by the son of financier August Belmont, the other by a family named Yoakum. And roaming one day far out in Suffolk County, near Wading River, he stumbled upon a magnificent brick and stone mansion set upon a bluff overlooking Long Island Sound that was not only deserted, but looked as if it had never been lived in. Inquiring later, he found out it never had. The man who commissioned the famous architect Stanford White to design it, and who named it Wildwood, financier Roland G. Mitchell, had died just as it was being finished in 1906, and the spacious, high-ceilinged rooms had remained shuttered and unfurnished ever since. Again and again, Moses returned to the lonely strand, not only to Jones Beach, but to Fire Island, where Estate Park, the only one on Long Island, was located, on the 200-acre grounds of the hotel the state had purchased in 1892 to house the passengers from the cholera-ridden Normania. In 1918, fire had destroyed the hotel, as well as the boardwalks and comfort stations that the state had erected, and when Moses stepped out of the bob, he found Fire Island State Park deserted. Charred ruins lay on the sand. The only undamaged structure was the 9-story-high wooden Fire Island telegraph tower, from which the sighting of arriving clipper ships had once been flashed to Manhattan. Studying maps, Moses was puzzled. They showed the park as comprising the westernmost portion of Fire Island, except for a little enclave on the island's tip, which was occupied by an unmanned Coast Guard station. The telegraph tower, which stood on the station, was shown at the very tip. But as Moses stood alongside the tower, the island stretched westward as far as he could see. Then he remembered what the baymen had told him about the set of the ocean. Since 1892, the waves had been piling sand on Fire Island's western end. He began to walk along the new land, and he walked for 4 miles. The Coast Guard station wasn't a little enclave anymore. Its area, he calculated, was at least 600 acres, and the station was deserted. No one even knew the added 600 acres were there. By the end of the summer of 1923, Moses knew that his plans for Long Island had been far too small. Now he wanted not just a state park on Jones Beach, but another one, which would include the unmapped 600 acres across the inlet on Fire Island. He wanted state parks on the South Shore, not just at the Taylor Estate, but in Hampton Bays and at Montauk Point. He wanted parks on the Sound, not just at Sunken Meadow, but at Wildwood, Lloyd Neck, and Orient Point. And he wanted 2 in the center of the island, at the Belmont and Yoakum Estates. He wanted 40,000 acres of parks. He wanted not just a parkway along the South Shore and one along the North Shore, but a parkway connecting them far out on Long Island, so that families from New York City could drive out on one, loop around, and drive home on the other without retracing their path. He wanted another parkway. He wanted 2 more parkways, linking both the Northern and Southern parkways with 2 causeways running to Jones Beach. He wanted still another parkway linking them with Fire Island. He wanted 124 miles of parkways. And he wanted the parkways to be broader and more beautiful than any roads the world had ever seen, landscaped as private parks are landscaped, so that they would be in themselves parks, ribbon parks, so that even as people drove to parks, they would be driving through parks. Near the latter part of the summer, Alfred E. Smith found himself being chauffeured around Long Island, with Moses sitting beside him, pointing and talking. Smith became enthusiastic about the plans. He asked Mrs. Moskowitz to look into the situation, and Moses gave her the full tour. She approved, and Smith told Moses that when the park program was submitted to the legislature in 1924, it could be expanded.
"Why don't you take the whole thing over yourself?" the governor asked. "Why don't I make you president of the Long Island State Park Commission?"
Years later, Moses could recall his thoughts.
"I had always had an interest in physical construction anyhow," Bella's son would remember. "And I had always had an interest in the outdoors. I had done a lot of hiking and fishing and swimming in the Adirondacks, remember? And I was very interested in parks, particularly in the Long Island work."
He said he would like the job. Chapter 10. The Best Bill Drafter in Albany.
Dreams, visions of public works on a noble scale, had been marching through Bob Moses' mind in almost continuous procession for a decade and more. Not one of them had marched out of his mind into reality. But during that decade, Bob Moses had learned what